Welcome, wildlife warriors, to the latest episode of the Conservationists Assemble podcast. This show collaborates with wildlife advocates worldwide to shed light on conservation challenges. Whether you're a nature expert or new to animal conservation, this is the podcast for you. I am your host, Johnny Bloxham, and in today's episode, we dive into the realm of the African painted dog. Join me and special guest Peter Blinston, the Executive Director of Painted Dog Conservation in Zimbabwe, as we explore the world of these special canids and the obstacles they encounter, unveil initiatives aimed at their protection, and learn how you can champion species survival. Let's give a warm welcome to Peter as he launches this wild journey on the Conservationists Assemble podcast. Peter, welcome to the podcast. I'm thrilled to have you on, and we're here to talk about all things painted dog conservation. So, how are you today?
Very good. Thanks, Johnny. Yeah, and thanks for the invitation to join your podcast.
You're more than welcome. I'm certainly excited to get as much reach from the podcast as possible and talk to as many guests all around the world. And you're coming to us from some Zimbabwe today and as Executive Director of Painted Dog Conservation. So firstly, can you tell us about painted dogs?
Yeah, sure. They're a carnivore. They're a pure carnivore in the sense that they rarely, if ever, scavenge. They only eat what they kill themselves. Live in extended family groups or packs, comprising a alpha female, alpha male. They're typically the only breeding pair. And then you'll have a number of adults and then offspring. And those adults are typically their brothers to the male and sisters to the alpha female. And then you'll have different age groups of offspring from that alpha pair. Some reach the age of sort of 2-3 years and then disperse, but others stay with their parents for longer and build up pack sizes. You can get packs as big, 30 plus is not uncommon, but they are typically 6 to 12 adults in a pack. And they're not a true dog. They're not related, they're a very distant relative of domestic dogs and wolves, to the point where they can't breed, which is a good thing. That's one problem. That kind of hybridization is one problem they don't have.
Fantastic, and I'm actually glad you touched on that, because hybridization was one of my notes to discuss, because there is, when we talk about threats to painted dogs, there is, some threats from domestic dogs, but it's good to know that hybridization isn't one of them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like Ethiopian wolves, for example, that is a problem. And obviously, wolves, your grey wolves, etc., they're very close relative to domestic dogs. So they can, breed, and then you get this kind of hybrid.
What kind of classification are we looking at for painted dogs in the wild and their population trends?
Yeah, they're endangered. They're IUCN red listed as endangered and in decline.
What are some of the main threats to them then?
The biggest threat is loss of quality habitat. And that's really with the expanding human population. Wildlife areas are shrinking on a daily basis. Then you get snaring, snares set for bushmeat, and painted dogs are very susceptible to that form of illegal hunting. Disease is an ever-present threat in a lot of populations. And you still get persecution from farmers in some areas. So that's probably the main threats.
Okay, so quite a wide range, that even though they're a very well-adapted species, it's providing an obstacle for them to certainly overcome.
Yeah, and the habitat is a really big issue across Africa. Where we operate extensively, poaching snares is probably the biggest threat to the population around Wangi National Park.
Yeah, so I believe I read Wangi National Park is one of kind of the last true strongholds for painted dog populations in the continent.
Yeah, it's a re it's quite a stable population, dare we say, growing. Our estimate for the Wangi National Park and surrounds population for last year, 2023, was high. It was approximately 250 individuals, which is the highest estimate it's had, or we've given it in, well, more than 25 years. So possibly we're bucking the trend of decline across the continent, but certainly it's a stable population in Wangi of 200 or so. But as you can see from that figure, it's still very small. I mean, 200 adult dogs is really not much, not much at all.
And I suppose when we talk about kind of poaching and snaring, are they the intended target for the snares? Because sometimes we hear it a lot with a lot of other animals that they're accidental bycatch. Are painted dogs the intended target?
No, they're also accidental bycatch. So they're typically your poacher, that illegal hunting activity, they're targeting small to medium size antelope. So in our area, that's duiker, bushbuck, impala, even up to kudu. And those are all prey species for painted dogs. So basically, their dogs are hunting for exactly the same species in exactly the same environment, and the wide-ranging nature of the dogs, that they can be here today and they can be 5, 10 kilometers away tomorrow, means the chances of them encountering a snare is extremely high.
Okay, so then what kind of methods are there to help ensure species survival for painted dogs?
Well, we have extensive community projects, outreach projects, education projects, or programs, and but we also have anti-poaching. I mean, we have 27 scouts that are deployed daily in sort of strategic locations to clear snares in different areas. So. And we have a pretty much a 24/7 monitoring program of the packs that are in those danger areas where there's we know, over the year we've been running anti-poaching units since 2001. So we know where the poaching hotspots are, and they're typically neighboring the sort of higher concentration of human populations.
And so focusing on those anti-poaching units a bit more then, what kind of training goes into preparing someone to become a member of an anti-poaching unit?
Yeah, I mean, you could say it's sort of it's paramilitary up to a point, but our anti-poaching units, they're not armed. We rare if we do encounter armed poachers, they're armed with a spear or an axe or something. They're not with a, they don't carry a weapon, a firearm. We have dogs. We have a couple of so we like Kano. We've got two German shepherds that patrol with our scouts. So the dog handling is one aspect of the training, but that's specific to four individuals out of the 27. And then it's fitness, it's awareness of bush knowledge, ability to track, you know, follow sign and spore on the ground, footprints, that kind of thing. Poachers leave sign, they leave indications, leading themselves back to where they set the snares. So it's that kind of training that to recognize, and then and just it's really it's a lot of it is on the job training. They become very experienced of to where a poacher would set snares in a certain habitat or environment.
Fantastic. And so can you tell us about some more of the other kind of programs that you have within the Painted Dog Conservation Organisation, such as the bush camp, like the educational programs that you mentioned also?
Yes, I mean, we're a multifaceted conservation organisation. We employ more than 70 individuals from all from local villages, or pretty much 95% are from the local villages around us. As I said, we run research monitoring programs. So we have staff in the field doing that. So they're monitoring various study packs on a day-to-day basis. We have the anti-poaching, as already mentioned. We've got a rehabilitation facility, so we bring in sick, injured, or orphan painted dogs, and do everything we can to get them back into the wild, back to their original pack, if possible, or we'll create a pack from the sort of waifs and strays that we get in. Occasionally, we have a permanent resident that just can't go back into the wild because of the nature of its injury, typically. We run an extensive education program, the centre of which is our four-day residential bush camp program. So that's aimed at children who are around 11 years old. They're grade six in our school system here. So they're typically 11, 12 years old. They have one more year of junior school before then going on to, which is grade seven, and then they go on to high school. And they come in, as I say, it's a four-day residential program. They learn all about the environment, concepts such as extinction, the interdependence upon of species on each other. It really is a tremendous program. And we follow that up with in-school programs under the umbrella of conservation clubs. We have community outreach programs. We partner with another local organization called Softfoot Alliance. There we're looking at permaculture programs, water harvesting, more holistic management of livestock, herding your livestock together and bomering that livestock at night to prevent predation or mitigate predation from predators. So quite a wide variety of programs. We sponsor a local soccer league. So yeah, there's a number of programs that we carry out.
Yeah, a couple of points I want to build on there. And hopefully our listeners will check out the Painted Dog Conservation website off the back of this episode. But some fantastic kind of case studies and evidence-based promotion for these projects when, you know, you still have examples of a painted dog taking a goat, for example, that is livestock, but actually, you know, some of your bush camp graduates, for lack of a better word, are from those villages where those goats are being taken, and actually off of the cuff of that, you wouldn't expect retaliation, but there's no kind of animosity towards the painted dogs now, which maybe, you know, wouldn't be the case if those community-based projects weren't happening.
Oh, absolutely. We had a very recent example of that where the sole survivor of one pack, which is like a 8-month-old pup, the other dogs in that pack have all perished in the last sort of 6 or 7 months. That female did predate on a goat, but there was no animosity or retribution. And we because of the general view is a goat is nothing compared to what the painted dogs do for our community. And you, the goat owner, it's your fault. You should just look after your goat better. You've been taught how to herd and protect your goats. You chose not to do that. You've lost one to a predator. It's your fault. That's the pretty much the attitude now. And it's taken 25 years to get there, but that's pretty much the attitude now of the communities that we interact with on a daily basis.
That's great, because we're not necessarily seeing that mimicked with other species, from namely lions, for example. There's still a lot of retaliation happening with that situation, but a lion replacing that. So hopefully, you know, that's something that we can see for lions in the future.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's species specific as such, although obviously we're working with, you know, painted dogs. It's all about the benefits. It's the benefits that we deliver, and the dogs deliver to the local communities. I mean, I can go back almost 10 years now when it was an alpha female of one of our packs was killed in a snare adjacent to this particular village. And my senior tracker, Jealous and Pofu, he took the carcass with one of our other staff, our community outreach officer, Dominic. They took the carcass, and there was a meeting going on, and they took the carcass of the dog and just placed it down there at the meeting and said, this is what's happened here. And there was a really strong reaction and outrage from the community at large, again, based on the dogs are doing a lot for us. The dogs built this classroom, the dogs drilled this borehole, the dogs are employing people from our village. We need to stand up and protect the dogs. And from that, they formed their own community anti-poaching unit, which still operates to this day. And we work collectively. I mean, last year there was about 150 individuals patrolling the forests around their villages. And we engage with them even more strategically at times during the real peak dry season when poaching is at its highest. And that has spread to other villages. So in total, there was over 200 people undertaking patrols in the forests around their villages to make the area safer for painted dogs. Right. I mean, I think there's obviously an aspect there. I mean, the people, they're not afraid of painted dogs. They're obviously a very different situation to lions. So they're certainly less tolerable of lion and hyena in the neighborhood from a safety, personal safety point of view, as well as the, you know, predation on livestock aspect. But it's largely comes down to benefits. What benefit you're living in these villages? It's a subsistence livelihood, barely making ends meet in the majority of cases. But you're expected to tolerate having this wildlife around you and amongst you. So there needs to be benefits. And we through our organization, we deliver a lot of benefits to the local communities. So there is that acceptance and tolerance for the painted dogs.
Yeah, put very eloquently. And I want to go back because you briefly mentioned the Football League, the Rhino Cup Champions League football, which is obviously probably not something that our listeners were expecting to come out of this conversation today. So could you tell us a little bit more about that and how that is aiding conservation?
Yeah, we started, the Soccer League was there. This is 20, more than 20 years. We started our anti-poaching efforts in 2001. So it was around then, 2001, 2002, that the head of our anti-poaching approached me then. And he said, there's this Soccer League. We want to form a team and be part of the Soccer League. So we started then with one supporter, just providing some resources to the league. We providing kit, that sort of thing to the teams. And then going forward, we just provided sort of some prize money and a cup and medals and at a very modest level. And that has just expanded to this Rhinos Cup Champions League thing, which was more funding. We're actually in need of funding for that because the generous sponsors that kind of elevated the league. I mean, it's a very big ambition. I mean, there's these Rhino Cup Champions League things in Mozambique. There's ours in Zimbabwe. I think there's one in Zambia and possibly one in Namibia, maybe Botswana, but that certainly was the ambition. But they've kind of they have hit on sort of financial hardship, so they've having to scale that back a little bit now. But it's just great means. I mean, the youth are involved, and typically or stereotypically, you would say that's the not your professional poacher. They're normally much older, but you're just your chance, your ad hoc poacher is in that age bracket. So it's sort of, if you can provide an alternative provide some recreation, provide activity. It's high unemployment in these areas. I mean, it's probably over 80% unemployment, which is slightly misleading because people are living off the fields. But it's very high unemployment. So with the sort of structuring this league the way it is now, where there's kit, there's prize, more prize money, there's money for transport to get teams from one location to another, there's more money for the administration. So now teams are practicing, they're training during the week because they've got a game at the weekend and that sort of thing. So it's really raised the level of that. And so it's a vehicle for us to then get your messaging across in terms of, conservation, protecting painted dogs, protecting the habitat, protecting the wildlife at large, the prey base for the painted dogs. So it's a vehicle for us to get that messaging across and keeping the sort of unemployed, maybe to some extent disenchanted youth, giving them something to focus on, something more positive to focus on.
It definitely sounds like a very unique and collaborative effort in terms of preventing, like say, poaching and hopefully spreading that good word instead. So going right back then, how did painted dog conservation come to exist and what are some of the major achievements that our listeners should be aware of?
Painted dog conservation, the origin of it really was back in the mid 1990s for a research project, somebody's PhD project in Wangi National Park, and it's sort of grown out of that. to what it is today, where, you know, we employ 70 odd people. And to be honest, that's the biggest achievement by far, that how we've managed to grow the organization into a internationally recognized conservation organization that employs over 70 local people in a number of different program areas, as I've outlined. The personal growth of a lot of those individuals is tremendous to see. Jealous, I mentioned earlier, Jealous and Paulful, he's just won the Tusk Wildlife Ranger Award for his 25 years of dedicated service. And that's a guy, with, you know, with respect to him, very humble background, working as a casual hand with national parks when we employed him as a tracker. And he didn't, you know, he knew the bush, but he couldn't tell the difference between a hyena footprint and a painted dog footprint when he started. But by now, he's internationally renowned, and well, this Prince William presented the award, the Tusk Wildlife Ranger Award. Very prestigious award and tremendous recognition for him. And I've got staff like Maria, who was selling baskets on the side of the road to try and make ends meet whilst we were building our facilities and infrastructure. I'd pass her most days and she'd always stop me and ask me questions and what's going on, but ask me questions about the dogs and wildlife in general. And to the point when things were finished and we started employing people, I'd like, we'd best give this lady a job because she's like super enthusiastic and interested. She's a Disney conservation hero. Now she's traveled to the United States, she's traveled to the UK, her sons are being educated at university level. Both of them actually are doing master's degrees at university now. So those are the things that really, I'd say, are the achievements as such. But any given day, you know, the team are out there monitoring these packs. They frequently pick up snares, the dogs, as we've mentioned, and just that being able to, I wish I never had to do it, but if just being able to dart that dog and remove the snare is a huge achievement, and it can make the difference between that pack thriving or just falling apart.
And on that note, obviously how actively involved you are with snare removal, we should then mention that once that snare removed, that is not the end of the story, because one of the other initiatives now is snare art. So could you tell us a little bit more about that kind of project?
There's a lot of craft industry. The carvings, beaded craft work is, you find that in one way or the other, you find that across Africa. What we decided to do is with the snares is, you know, try and turn something that's deadly into something that's more positive. So we had a lady helped us. She came over from America, a lady called Wendy Blakely, and she came over from America and sort of organized this, what we call Iganyana arts. Iganyana is the local Ndebele name for painted dogs, and retrained people that were doing carving, making typical wooden curios, retraining them to work with wire and produce now, you know, animal imagery, whatever you call it, statues, sculptures out of the snail wire. And that continues to this day.
Going back to then painted dogs, what actions need to happen to kind of improve the chances of survival for painted dogs?
You need, multiple factors in play. I mean, in Zimbabwe, painted dogs are specially protected by the government. So they're, it's a serious offence if you are caught having killed one. It's mandatory 9 years in jail. There's degrees of that level of protection across different range states. I'd be lying if I knew exactly what it was from country to country, but you need that level of protection, and you need appropriate land management. A lot of national parks are national parks in name only, and they don't have the resources to be managed as they should and managed effectively. So there needs to be more resource into the management of protected areas. And then there needs to be this delivery of benefits to communities that now border these protected areas, which you need massive areas for, certainly for species like dogs, but all wildlife, you need massive areas. Wangi National Park is 15,000 square kilometers. I mean, that's probably the size of Dorset, Hampshire, and maybe some other county as well combined. I'm not sure, but it's of that scale, and it's not fenced. So you've got then a buffer zone surrounding that, which is typically mixed land use, community, safari areas, until you get into absolutely communal areas. So you have communities living right on the border of this. So first you've got to protect that area properly and have adequate resources to manage it and manage it appropriately, not favoring one species or another, but just manage that protected area. And then have programs that deliver benefits to the people that are living on the edge of those protected areas, so that they gain benefits from living with this wildlife. So they tolerate having that wildlife amongst them. And, you know, then there's a reasonably bright, if you can put all those sort of pieces of the puzzle together, there's a reasonably bright future for all wildlife, not just painted dogs.
Where do you see your donations coming from, and what kind of resources or work do those donations fund?
Well, in our case, the majority of our donations come from individuals. But we have some majors like Tusk and David Shepherd Wildlife Foundation are our two major UK-based charities, and they've both been supporting us for over 25 years. Tremendous level of support from them, both not only financially, but just in terms of general support and morale boosting and always there when you need them kind of thing. Because it's, you know, life on the front line of conservation is pretty tough. There's a lot of tough days for sure, but and then we largely, as I said, largely from individuals in our case, from, you know, school children to multi millionaire, very, you know, very wealthy individuals. And it's, they obviously, they support every aspect of our organization, from you know, keeping the anti-poaching guys equipped and in the field, to paying the phone bill, to fixing the Land Rovers, that kind of thing. So some funding we get is very specified. Mm-hmm. So some people would rather say, yeah, I want my $10 to go towards the children's bush camp. I want my dollar to go towards anti-poaching. Others will just give a donation, and it's used this way you see fit. So, and you need both. Nobody really likes to pay the phone bill and the electricity bill and everything, but they're all important aspects. I mean, you cannot run an organization this scale of ours without that level of, you know, obviously an office and infrastructure, and you know, you need money to buy ink for the printer and so forth. So it's always good to have a mixture of that unspecified and specified funding, and we're fortunate that we have that. And we've had, as I said, with David Shepherd and Tusk, certainly the longest, but we've had individuals that have been supporting us as well for more than 20 years. So we're quite privileged in that regard. We get some funding. We get about $50,000 a year from zoos worldwide. If you exclude Disney, we get Disney of their conservation fund, which is actually, well, it's not, it's raised through all of their activities at Disney World, not only the wildlife area, but all the outlets. Zoos have a, I mean, I grew up in England. I would go into zoos. Zoos have a huge role to play in, certainly that education and awareness role is massive. You know, breeding animals, you know, I've heard it in different places that should remain nameless, you know, that, yeah, we're breeding them to release, you know, to just in case you have to repopulate in the wild. I mean, I can say specifically painted dogs. And I'm like, that's just never going to happen. I mean, that's like, you know, you're spinning a line there that is far from the truth. But the role in terms of raising awareness and educating people is huge. Because at the end, I mean, how many people go to zoos worldwide compared to how many people travel to Zimbabwe, you know, Kenya, whatever? I mean, it's the off the scale. So there's a huge role to play in that regard. The exhibits, yeah, some I know, I won't name them, but I could name them, that they should be, not, if not, they shouldn't be shut down, but their collection should be changed completely, because they've got animals in, you know, totally unsuitable exhibits for that species. But there's for every, you know, bad one, there's probably 100 superb ones.
Yeah, so it's always going to be a very political one, isn't it, as well? Is yeah. You know, and it's something that's difficult to navigate.
Advocate. I mean, yeah, I'm an advocate for zoos, you know. The role that they play in educating people, as I say, and, you know, just the role they played in my life. You know, even that, I mean, if I, you know, in my day, you know, there wasn't as much on as much as I watched the documentary about the dogs on TV, there wasn't as much on TV as there is now, in terms of wildlife documentaries. But there's still, it's doesn't, you know, going to the zoo and, you know, being able to see and smell and hear for real that animal is a very different experience. So as long as, you know, the exhibits are good, which on the whole they are, the vast majority are, the animals are really well cared for and looked after and everything, which on the whole, again, absolutely they are. And then, yeah, then supporting in situ conservation, and it's the level of support. Then, you know, you can, again, I won't name names, but you know, we'll get $400 from a zoo that then has huge publicity, you know, information and stuff. So about the, you know, they're supporting painted dog conservation. And then there's all about our programs and this, that, and the other. But they give us $500, and I'm like, you just, there's nothing I can say.
Mm.
But I'm like, you kind of claiming, you know, the you're giving the impression that your support is way more significant than it is.
Yeah.
You know, at least what I look at then is it's not so much the support, it's the awareness now of how, you know, they've got stuff all over their websites, links to our website, social media and everything like that. So who knows what we may get other financial support from individuals because of that, and you would never necessarily know unless they said so. So no, there's, it's like you say, it's quite a political debate, but you know, we're a supporter. I'm a supporter of zoos. So
yeah, I think it's also just making that platform for those conversations to be had, because I suppose there's a lot that can be left up to assumption if those conversations aren't had, because yeah, it's easy to have that them and us kind of mindset until you're actively meshing or having those conversations about in situ and in situ collaboration. No one knows.
Yeah, I mean, Wilson, so Wilton, so guy Wilton Samango runs our education and community programs. So he goes to there's zoos and aquariums, zoos and aquariums committing to conservate or committed to conservation in the States, and he goes to that every year. I think it's coming up soon. It's if it's not April, it's May. You know, we participated in that. We have a foundation. We don't get much from the zoos in the UK. It's been ad hoc.
Sure.
We get quite good support from the Netherlands. We've got a foundation in the, basically a painted dog conservation charity in the Netherlands. And the chairman of that, Ron van der Aar, he's really active. Burgers Zoo is currently we've had Alec van Hoff Burgers Zoo out by Arnhem there. It's like a family-owned zoo. It incredible place. And ironically, they don't have dogs.
Hmm.
But they do a tremendous amount of conservation work. I mean, they give us we've got a 5-year commitment of, you know, a reasonable, you know, 5-figure sum each year. So it's not only the amount. I mean, it's a decent amount, plus the commitment over 5 years means that you can helps with your kind of planning and, you know, how are you going to use that money in the different program areas. But it's not only us. I mean, they support. He does a lot. They've got an incredible mangrove exhibit. It's just absolutely stunning. And they do a lot in Latin America. They're tremendous, tremendous example of that ex and in situ partnership. Tremendous exhibits.
Fantastic. I think there's a shift happening. It's slow, as everything is in conservation, unfortunately. But yeah, certainly the standards are getting better, and like I said, it's a shame that there's so many endangered species and so many fantastic organisations that need funding, you know. So Peter, thank you for giving us an insight into painted dogs and painted dog conservation. We're now going to switch track and we're going to focus on you for a little bit and just learn a little bit about you. So I guess firstly is what do painted dogs mean to you personally?
That's an interesting question, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in England and I first saw painted dogs on TV. I was about 8 years old and I watched this documentary called Solo, which was filmed by Jane Goodall and her husband then, Hugo van Loyck, who was a Dutch cinematographer. And it told a story about this one individual little puppy in the Serengeti in Tanzania. There's a book of the same name, and if you rummage around you can still get copies of that book, and you can get copies of the documentary. So I was captivated. I don't know if I had an interest in wildlife before that, which is why I watched the documentary, or watching the documentary sparked the interest in wildlife, but certainly in dogs, painted dogs. And I've they've always had for many, many years, I've had an affinity and an affection for them. To me, they are the proverbial underdog. They're not, if people, your general public, talk about Africa and wildlife, they're going to talk about elephants and lions and giraffe and zebra, rhino. Painted dogs only start to come into the conversation if people see them on safari and are then repeat safari goers. They're not, I'm going to, you know, it's a bucket list thing to go on safari and they tick that box and they never go again. But repeat safari goers who have seen the dogs really always want to see them, because in an effective functioning pack of 6 to 12 or more individuals, there's so much happening. I mean, other than, you know, during the like heat of the day when they're just resting, the social structure, the interaction between the individuals, and that's even before you throw pups into the equation, which pups are pups and they just never stop playing and rough and tumble and everything. And the feature of the dogs where they really do care for each other. They look after the sick, the injured, the old. There's this collective parenting of the pups, feeding the pups, protecting them. There's a lot we can learn from the dogs. Their societies, in many ways, is a lot better than ours.
And so then from watching that documentary as an 8-year-old, what was your journey into, packing your bags and hopping on a plane to Zimbabwe?
I certainly didn't follow what might be considered the traditional route, which like through academia sort of thing. I'm not a scientist. I've got management background and experience, but I've more than that. I've just got passion, driving passion and determination. And what ultimately led me out to Zimbabwe was probably a midlife crisis, to be honest. And just sick and tired of a pretty mundane life in England. I've traveled a lot. I've been to Africa. I've been fortunate to do, many safaris. Didn't see dogs as much as I wanted to on those safaris. Did some volunteer work for different organizations and ended up reading an article in a magazine about a guy called Greg Rasmussen, who was then that he was then what working on the painted dogs in Wangi. It was just him, basically. And contacted David Shepherd Foundation and spoke to Mel Shepherd. And Mel Shepherd just encouraged me to get involved, do something, volunteer, which is basically what I did. And she's been a constant support and encourager and for close to 30 years. And that's what I did. So I just was like, okay, look, I'll come out and help you. I'll try and make a difference. And I went out for 6 months. Actually, I went out for a couple of weeks initially and then went out just to see what was going on. And then I'm like, okay, I can come out for 6 months and there's a few things I'll be able to do from a management point of view to put some structure and shape into place. And that was coming up to 26 years ago, so I'm still here.
6 months turned into 26 years. And so you got your feet on the ground, you got yourself established and was like, right, yeah, I'm staying. What was one of your first experiences with painted dogs in the field?
We're jealous. One of the packs that for us are sort of iconic individual we called Eye Spot, and his brother was the alpha male, and the with the alpha female, his brother was called we called Arrow, and his alpha female was Crescent, and they denned on outside of the Wangi National Park in an area sort of referred to as Gwai Conservancy, not far from the main road, one of the main roads in Zimbabwe. I mean, it's only a single lane road, but they're running from Bulawayo to Victoria Falls. And they den not far from there. And poaching, that was like 1998, and poaching wasn't really an issue then, but we're still Jealous and I were the anti-poaching unit, and we would just sleep rough in the bush, like a couple of hundred yards away from the den, and go on patrols to pick up snares and just protect the area as best we could, and then the Arrow was killed. So Eye Spot's brother Crescent was injured. She couldn't hunt. So now this dog, he was, I think he was 2 years old at the time. This dog is now hunting on his own to feed her and his brother's pups. And just what we witnessed and experienced there was just incredible. I mean, to see this little dog on his own providing for his basically, what would they be? His cousins. and his so to speak, was just incredible. And you know, if I didn't already have an affinity for the painted dogs, I certainly did by that point.
Yeah, it's certainly kind of awe-inspiring, and obviously not to put human behaviours onto it, but just to see how mature that individual would have had to have become on such short notice.
Yeah, incredible. And it really, it was just astonishing to see his efforts on a daily basis. You know, to keep, and he succeeded basically. And no sooner had she left, she was sort of joining to hunt, she got injured herself and then couldn't help anymore. So yeah, he had to just continue on his own for a couple of months of providing for all of them. So yeah, it was quite special. It was a very emotional time, that's for sure.
So yeah, on the flip side of that, because you mentioned earlier as well how obviously on the front lines, you know, a lot of the days are very tough. So do you have any kind of fun stories or light-hearted stories from your time around painted dogs as well?
yeah, probably if I sit and chat with Jealous, but no, there's lots of good days. I mean, just, you know, being with the dogs, especially again, a healthy, thriving pack. Just there's so many good days where you're with them and just enjoy being with them, observing them. But the good days are really often come as a result of a successful intervention. Like removing a snare or something like that, where you know, you're under immense pressure and you can see the suffering of the individual, because these snares are brutal. I mean, and some of the injuries that they cause, it's like the dogs have, their throats have been cut by a knife, you know, like a sharp knife, but it hasn't. It's been cut by basically a blunt instrument, of just a piece of wire. To, you know, a couple of millimeters in diameter. So we've certainly had some, I mean, most people wouldn't regard it as fun, but we've had some incidents where, you know, we've just been involved rescuing dogs from, you know, situations, or you're putting yourself in extreme risk to help that individual and it all goes well. And you know, you can have a good laugh at the end of that day that you've survived, and the dog is now much better off because you've got the snare removed from it. So, but there's lots of good days. The good days are just being with the dogs and enjoying them and watching the interaction and playfulness of them, the social side of things.
I can tell, yeah, you get a real enjoyment around being with the dogs. And so what advice would you give to someone who maybe they're in a similar position to you, they're not necessarily from Africa, but they want to get involved with conservation?
I do get a lot of requests, and it's hard. It's really hard. I mean, for us, our priority is creating opportunity for people from the local villages. You know, my personal situation doesn't really exist nowadays. But to me, it's about focus. And being determined. You know, I was determined, as I say, I was leading a pretty mundane life in the UK. But okay, I was comfortably off. I wasn't wealthy or anything like that, but I was okay. And that are just determined to do something that mattered, that made a difference, and keep and being focused on that. I think that's what's really important. And the path to where you want to be is may not be the you know what you think, but certainly if people it's more likely if people want to work in conservation, they're more likely to achieve that following a more traditional not doing something, not having a midlife crisis like me and just selling your apartment and packing your bag and getting on a plane, but following a more structured academic path. And there seems to be much more opportunity in that regard now in terms of study, of academic study towards conservation. And you know, start at home. Start in your there's a lot of serious conservation issues in the UK. Start at home, get involved with local organizations, get involved with Tusk and David Shepherd Foundation, you know, those kind of organizations, and many more besides.
So yeah, very true. Like say, the UK certainly is a nature depleted area of the planet, probably one of more so. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how getting involved with UK conservation could be a foundation for then spreading your wings and getting involved in more further afield conservation efforts. Just going to finish on some quick fire questions, just fun, light-hearted ones. So are there any dream species that you'd love to see in the wild?
Oh, yeah. Wolves, definitely. Tigers, polar bears, grizzly bears. Those kind of... Probably, I don't know, it'd be hard to pick between tigers and wolves is which I would want to see the most. But, yeah.
And then... maybe prior to leading up to where you are now, was Africa the one continent that you kind of really wanted to visit above any other, or was there any other places that you'd like to extend or spend an extended period of time?
Africa was always the continent, and I as a kid, you know, from 8 years old, I wanted to visit and spend as much time as I possibly could. I wouldn't want to spend an awful lot of time there, but I'd like to visit Antarctica. As much as I want to see wolves and tigers, if there was one place I would, it's very much top of where I would like to visit and not spend extended time, but visit, would be Antarctica for sure.
Yeah, I can get on board that completely. Yeah, different to anywhere else on the planet. And when you're not working, Peter, how do you keep busy?
I'm always working, to be honest, as my friends and family would testify to. But I've got a good mate, and we're very, very bad at golf, but we play golf. I can't even say it's once a month. He probably plays once a month. I might play once with him at once every 2 or 3 months. But that's good fun. I exercise a lot. I go particularly when I'm in. So my time is split between Wangi and Harare. I'm in Harare at the moment. My son's at school here. So I'm kind of back and forth between Harare and Wangi all the time. I exercise a lot. I like going to the gym and that kind of thing. I love cricket as well. So I suppose I'm mainly watching it on TV, I guess. But we do have some cricket matches here, and I know I'm privileged to know you know, a few of the Zimbabwe cricket team and some of the staff associated with it. So that's good fun.
So yeah, just generally staying active.
Yeah.
So what is the, if there is one thing, but what is one thing that you think our listeners should take away from today's episode?
The conservation is a very challenging industry for many factors. It's under-resourced in general. If you look at, as much as there's hundreds of millions of dollars spent on conservation, it's actually a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of funding that goes in, you know, compared, if you like, compared to medical, compared to religion, compared to education, in terms of like, so like donor funding, for example, the amount that goes into religion, education, medical is like just off the scale compared to what goes into conservation. I mentioned before, a lot of these, particularly across Africa, a lot of protected areas are protected in name only. They're under-resourced. So conservation, really, that awareness and the need for more support is high. It's the situation is quite dire in terms of this loss of quality habitat and species populations, not just painted dogs, being in decline. And once they're gone, they're gone. They're gone forever. You know, there's that expression, isn't there? Extinction is forever. So that awareness, people need to be aware that it's challenging. It's a challenging environment. It's a challenging industry, and needs as much support as is possible.
And then lastly, then, how can our listeners keep up to date with the work of Painted Dog Conservation?
Yeah, our website, you know, we and our social medias, we do all of that. I don't, thankfully. I have someone else, but we do all of that. Facebook and Instagram and whatever, those other social media outlets. And we have a quarterly newsletter, which is emailed out, so people can subscribe to that. You can go onto our website, painteddog.org, and subscribe to the newsletter that way, or the newsletter's posted on our website anyway. So yeah, we're quite easy to keep in touch with. Wangi, Zimbabwe as a whole, is a tremendous destination. Come and visit. It's a very safe country. There's great safari infrastructure. Victoria Falls, Wangi, the Mana Pools areas, the Lowveld, Gonera Zoo. There's some just tremendous wildlife areas in Zimbabwe, and it's very safe to travel around. Good infrastructure to get from one place to the other. So yeah, come and visit. But it's not cheap, I would say that. So it's a long way for a lot of people, from people from the UK. It's certainly, it's quite a journey, but it's well worth it.
A perfect note to end up on there. So, Peter, a massive shout out to you for gracing the podcast with your knowledge and your passion on painted dogs. We'll be sure to keep up to date on all of the developments with painted dog and painted dog conservation. So, yeah, thank you for your time today.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity. And I look forward to listening to other podcasts from other people.
Once again, thank you for tuning in today. If the painted dog discussion caught your interest, show your support by liking, sharing and reviewing the podcast. Help us expand our wildlife community and create more exciting episodes for you. Feel free to send in your questions, suggest species for future highlights, or share your painted dog photos and videos. Connect with us on Instagram or via email at conservationistassemble@outlook.com. I'm Johnny Bloxham, your host, signing off another thrilling episode of the Conservationist Assembled podcast. Until next time.